I'm Carl Quintanilla. You're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in. Good Friday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Fort and Julia Boorstin. Today, trying to hang on to this rally to kick off October, NASDAQ is coming off its worst month since the start of the pandemic. Will Q4 bring more pain for tech? Plus, what did we actually learn from Facebook? The stock led most of big tech lower in September, but is it oversold at this level? And then later, an exclusive with the head of Amazon Devices as we test out the camera on wheels that is the new robot, Astro. First, though, we'll start with stocks and names trading at a relative bargain to begin the quarter. Dom's got that for us. Hey, Dom.
I mean, the sell-off there, driven in large part by interest rate concerns and also, of course, some headline risk, certainly on the regulatory front, affecting a lot of that big tech and media trade over the course of not just September, but the quarter overall as well. Now, if you take a look at the broader context for the Dow, the S&P 500 and NASDAQ, you can see that the NASDAQ has now, because of that recent underperformance, taken a bit of a leg lower versus the S&P, slightly above the Dow right now. But that big move in the green line lower here from the record highs that we've seen has been really kind of the outpacing to the downside story we've been talking about. Now, if you take a look overall at some of the interesting parts of that particular kind of thematic trade in technology and media, it has really been the internet stocks, some of those that have really kind of fared some of the worst here. You can see over the course of the quarter day period, the big internet funds like the First Trust Dow Jones Internet down about 3.25% there. The tech software ETF is up about 2.5%, and same with the cloud computing side of things. But it's this far move to the downside here that has a lot of people wondering whether or not there are bargains out there. Some of the former high flyers that we've seen that have really pulled back a bit over the course of the last couple of months and then certainly the quarter. Look at Pinterest shares up 5% today, some maybe dip buying happening there. But over the course of the year-to-date period, a real underperformer. And as you can see here, that sharp move lower over the course of the quarter has really caught some attention there. Also, check out what's happening with other parts of the market, not just in social media there, but check out Zoom Video up at 2.5% today, year-to-date down 20%. Has this sharp drop lower over the course of the quarter really caused things to really accelerate to the downside and perhaps pick up some of that kind of interest in buying beaten down stocks? And then, of course, another one to watch as well is Roku, another momentum name that has had a fairly sharp drop off over the course of the quarter period, now down 7%. So many of these stocks like Roku, like Pinterest, like Zoom, all of these hitting some levels that might trigger at least some interest, folks, in some of the interest in buying that we're seeing today. I'll send things back over to you.
All right, Dom, thanks very much. And speaking of Zoom, the second biggest tech merger of the year has been officially scrapped. Five9 shareholders rejected Zoom's $14.9 billion bid for the cloud contact center company. The shareholders feeling the 13% premium from the value of their shares prior to the July agreement was not enough. Their feelings may be justified after Square paid a nearly 30% premium to Afterpay shareholders. That $29 billion deal, the biggest tech acquisition so far this year. Analysts have been relatively encouraged by the move, Five9 receiving at least six upgrades on Thursday, including Wells, Evercore, and Barclays. John, we all know what's happened, that Dom was just saying, this correction as we see more reopening plays take place. Cramer's point has been that Zoom needs to show us what Zoom 2.0 is going to be, and this was, I guess, ostensibly going to be that.
Yeah, this was going to be that. It'll be interesting to hear what Eric's plan B is. And I mean, if nothing else, this is great marketing for Five9. We weren't talking about it nearly as much before as we are now. But think about the risks that Five9 shareholders had to think about. I mean, when this deal was announced back in July, Zoom's stock was at what, around 350? Now it's at around 270. So, and it's been, I mean, if you look at the trajectory over the past 12 months of Zoom shares, they have really been heading on a downward slope, Julia. And so back when we first talked about this deal, it was in the context of these high flyers. How are they going to use their stock as currency? How are they going to use this valuation to head into the next phase? And Zoom seemed to be buying some enterprise stability, not doubling down on the more ephemeral consumer and smaller business attention that they were getting. There are other ways to do that. We'll see if Eric Yuan and his team can pull something else out.
Yeah, and when you talk, John, about the focus on the enterprise, I mean, that really seems to be the future as we move into more of a permanent hybrid work environment in the sense that companies have to be ready for both. So it'll be interesting to see if Zoom pursues other acquisitions. And then for the question of what happens with Five9, you have to see if they end up selling for premium. The name of the game here seems to be significant premiums. It was also, you know, want to mention that Microsoft paid, I believe it was a 23% premium for Nuance. So this precedent is being set here that companies in this space, Carl, can really demand a significant premium. Five9 didn't get a big enough premium, and that really seemed to be what scuttled the deal.
Yeah, interesting how the valuations have been creeping into investor psychology. We deserve more than that. Let's get back to Facebook meantime. As you know, the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Consumer Protection questioned the company's global head of safety yesterday in a series after that series of reports from the Wall Street Journal revealing Facebook's internal research on how its products affect young women.
This research is a bombshell.
Facebook is just like Big Tobacco, pushing a product that they know is harmful to the health of young people.
You're telling us if only you knew the full research, and then at the same time you're not releasing the research. So which is it?
This seems to be a recurring theme with this company. Do everything and anything to mold the world into your own image for your own profit.
The question does remain as to whether this ultimately will hobble the company. The stock's down nearly 10% since that first report. It is up slightly following the hearing. Julia, we talked about some of the political circularity yesterday, and I know Blumenthal's been beat up a little bit about his comment about Finsta, but it is being used as a moment that sort of encapsulates the degree to which Congress has got to get up to speed on some of these tech issues.
Yes, and just to explain what you're referencing there, Finsta is this idea that anyone can create a fake Instagram account, and Blumenthal was really holding Facebook to account for that, saying that this is their fault. It's not a product, it's not a feature, it's just a behavior that people have. But I think that that's sort of the center of this whole debate, Carl. I mean, is bad behaviors, manipulative things, or things that people make people depressed, is that the fault of Facebook? Is it being exacerbated by Facebook? And Facebook's defense was really that they're sort of more of a mirror of society and are doing their best. But one thing I think, John, will be interesting to watch is whether this permanently ends Facebook's interest in doing an Instagram for kids. And we'll see whether we get one of these kids acts or some sort of legislation that's really intended to crack down on manipulative marketing or some of these features on apps targeting kids that are considered more dangerous.
Julia, I'm still caught up in this Greek tragedy of Antigone Davis. Why did Facebook throw her to the wolves like this? I mean, this is a situation, clearly, if you're Zuckerberg or if you're Sandberg, you don't want to be the one to have to face the music on this one. But what did Antigone do to deserve that? I don't know.
Well, my theory here is that Facebook wants to have the people who are experts in each category answer questions about that category. Of course, when you go before Congress, these hearings can be all over the place, right? So if these senators were asking questions just specifically about safety, then she probably would have been able to answer all of them. But we all know that these hearings end up being relatively sort of wide-ranging in their interest and in their scope. And maybe it's better for Facebook to put someone out there who doesn't have to answer all the questions about everything if this hearing is supposed to be just about the safety and that date of that expose.
Yeah. John, I mean, it is interesting.
Is it better for Facebook or?
I think the street is beginning to see a pattern where if it's a product rollout, if you're going to roll out rooms or reels, then you hear from Mark. But if it's a policy issue, it's definitely not Mark.
Yeah, I want to see Antigone Davis hitting Zuckerberg with a pillow next. We'll see how that video goes. Well, all right. Meantime, Amazon revealing its first home robot this week, the Astro, an Alexa-powered robot. It's priced right around $1,000. At first, it's only going to be sold by invitation from Amazon. So in a Tech Check exclusive, I spent some time with SVP Dave Limp at Amazon's Seattle headquarters, an interview you'll see more of later in the show. But first, we had to test out Astro, see how it works in real life.
Astro, go to the kitchen. When you set up the device, it maps through the house, and then you can do a home tour, and you get to name all the rooms. Astro, raise the camera. So we built this pretty cool mask cam, so if you're away and you want to see if the stove is on, or you want to look and see if you left an iron on, or those kinds of things. Astro, follow me. You'll see it moves pretty fast, too, up to a meter a second. It understands what's around it. It's also real-time looking for changes, too. If I throw something down in front of it, it's going to know not to path plan through the pillow, but go around it. It has the kinds of functionality that you would expect with Alexa, too. So I can say, Astro, play Castle on the Hill by Ed Sheeran.
Castle on the Hill by Ed Sheeran on Amazon Music.
You can see now there's eyes on the display. That is the default kind of home screen for the device. We learned about halfway through the project that customers just seeing the typical kind of Echo Show screen here, that didn't resonate with them. Go to your charger. Then once it has a charge, if you want it to, come back to certain parts of the home and kind of settle in where you're hanging out.
And Julia, as you might expect, I had questions about security. There's some pretty good answers, like what happens when somebody's trying to remotely control Astro while somebody's at home. It turns out the person at home has the power to shut down the robot if they don't want to be talked to or spied on. Also, measures in place to make sure that others can't take remote control of Astro and hack into it. You have to re-log in if it's been taken outside of the Wi-Fi network, things like that. So they have thought this through, but a robot with cameras and a microphone in the home, not for everybody, Julia.
Yeah, I know, John, we talk a lot about privacy and whether or not Americans really care about privacy. But my question really is, first, stairs. Can this thing go on stairs? And second, who is this for? I've got plenty of robots in my house. I can ask Google and Alexa to set timers for me. But why do I need something following me around?
Yeah, especially, John.
I've got plenty of robots in my house, Julia. Wow.
Although this one moves around the house, as you showed us, and reads faces, there's been a lot of discussion this week about, remember all the privacy debates about what kind of information the police can get from Ring or Nest or Alexa. Now you got one that can literally tell who's who in the household. It would give police a lot more information than they have on those other devices.
Right. If you choose to share that information with them. Julia, to answer your question a bit, there's an elder care, an elder kind of help element to this that can be part of it. Also, you can monitor pets. Carl, I had questions about the cat friendliness of Astro. Cats like to attack things. You know, Dave said that they did a lot of pet testing. Not with my cat, though. And I know, Julia, you know, you've got a couple cats as well. So it cannot handle stairs. Stairs are the bane of this thing's existence. It stays away from stairs. You don't want it going anywhere near the stairs.
I will be very curious to check this out, John. I have a feeling my two cats would not be a fan of it. And meanwhile, with the Nasdaq on pace for its worst week since February, time to get into big tech. Tech is just getting started. Let's get a gut check on some fintech names. The September slide hitting PayPal and Square, both those stocks down 10% to end the month. But the street bullish on PayPal. It's one of their favorite stocks going into the fourth quarter, according to CNBC Pro.
Meantime, got an unstable end of the quarter yesterday. As you know, we got that heavy fall on the major indices and all the sectors closed out the day in the red. Heading into the last quarter of the year now, investors are notably switching from sectors like tech into so-called value shares like banking and energy. With us this morning, break down his overall thoughts on this frenetic 2021 is Wedgewood Partners CIO David Rolfe. David, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Carl. Thanks.
You've got a pretty interesting even weight, I'd say, between infotech and, say, finance. I wonder whether or not the prospect of higher rates, more hawkish central banks all around the world, is making you nervous about part of that.
Well, certainly we've seen, Carl, where, you know, when the 10-year's up, value roars and growth, particularly big tech, gets hit really hard. But as our thinking has evolved, we're really starting to pay attention to what some of these CEOs and other executives are saying on these earnings call. It's really interesting, Carl. We keep on hearing this idea that once we get back to normal, once we get back to 2019, and I'm starting to think that maybe 2019 wasn't normal. Maybe 2019 was perfect. When you think about maybe Fed policy back then. Certainly, we don't have all these supply chain and logistic issues and employment issues. I mean, when I think back to 2019, if I maybe coin a thought, Carl, it was like Spinal Tap 11. It was perfect. And so when we look at, we only own about 20 stocks. But when we hear all of the issues, particularly the permanent ones, the sticky ones, like freight costs and the difficulty of finding good employees. I mean, we saw the ISM number today. Good headline. But if you look at some of the comments, just nothing but supply chain problems. But interestingly enough, yeah, we'll get past this COVID stuff hopefully very soon and some type of normalization. But when you look at supply, I mean, the supply of labor, people willing to work maybe some jobs that they don't want to work anymore. I think the new normal is maybe what we're seeing now. And this idea that we're going to somehow magically get back to 2019. Well, we're not holding our breath on that thought.
So you see, let me game this out. So you think that you could normalize COVID and activity, but somehow we're in this new regime of long-lasting inflation? We've had that discussion over and over again through the decades, and it just hasn't worked out.
You're absolutely right. But maybe at this point, when we think about inflation, and again, I'm no economist, but it does seem, if you look over history, if you're going to have some sustained inflation, you probably need sustained wage inflation. And, you know, I've been in the business 35 years now. I can't think of a time where prospective employees probably had more bargaining power than they've ever had. So, again, when you just see what corporate America is saying, that they have a hard time hiring across all ranks. And again, with this, particularly in the white collar area, with the thought of a lot of people, maybe they do want to work from home and employers don't want to lose those great employees that can be very effective at home. I think it is a new day on the inflation front when you consider labor issues.
So, David, speaking of working at home, let's maybe get a little narrower on this situation. Is there any broader lesson from the 86ing of this 5-9 deal? Because Zoom, which was a pandemic high flyer, was looking, it seemed, to kind of stabilize and move out and broaden out into a different kind of business. And now it can't do that. Is there something investors in general should take away from that?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you saw the movement of some of these stocks when COVID hit, I mean, it was astonishing. And it was a sea change within tech. And again, not to use this word again, but we're starting to see some normalization of these business models. And again, you know, the idea that this merger is not going to go through. But I mean, you know, we don't have a position in Zoom, and our focus is in some other areas of tech right now.
Well, so with that in mind, David, with all these themes you just laid out, what are your interests right now? What are the best overlooked opportunities in tech?
I think one that, well, it's certainly not sexy, but it's a great business and the stock's even better. It's called CDW, and they are a value-added reseller, particularly for small and medium businesses. A better way to think of them is that they are the IT department for 250,000 customers, small and medium businesses, education, government, and healthcare, and they typically grow 2 times the rate of the overall IT business. Again, a $25 billion market cap, not a big sexy name, but if you look at the stock over the last 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, it's crushed the S&P 500. So it does have returns like the big tech Goliaths. And what's really interesting about the business model, it scales beautifully. And if you look at the return on working capital of this business, over the past 10 years or so, it's gone from 40% to 60%. And maybe the best news of all, in this environment where tech is still selling at a pretty good premium, the company should earn about $8.50 a share in calendar 22. That's only 21 times for a mid-teens grower that literally has their foot in every aspect of IT spending.
Which is a huge deal, as we know, given everything we just talked about. David, a little macro, a little micro today. Appreciate it very much. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, Carl. Thanks again.
We're resetting here near the bottom of the hour. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Julia Boorstin and John Ford. Market's going to keep you guessing today. Dow was up 220, then red, now back up 220. NASDAQ coming off the worst month since the start of the pandemic. Rally faded, but the index, as we said, did turn green a few moments ago. Get more on that in a second. In the meantime, a news update with Rahel Solomon. Hi, Rahel.
Good morning, and here's what's happening at this hour. Shares of Merck jumping 9%. and on track for their biggest one-day gain in more than 5 years. The company announcing a pill that, in a late-stage trial, reduced the risk of hospitalization or death by COVID 50%. The news is slamming the stocks of some vaccine makers. Novavax shares are down about 19%. Consumer sentiment rising more than expected in September, although it still remains below the pre-pandemic high. The increase comes despite continuing inflation concerns and lingering impacts from the Delta variant surge in COVID cases. U.S. manufacturing activity also strengthening, even as factories battle higher input prices and labor shortages. The ISM's manufacturing index getting a boost from improved supplier deliveries. And accounting and consulting giant PwC is making remote work a permanent option for some 40,000 workers. All U.S. client services employees will be able to work virtually and live anywhere, but they will need to come into the office for up to 3 days a month for in-person appointments and meetings. John, if only we could do the news from a beach in St. Thomas or, I don't know, Bali.
Or from a rooftop in San Francisco. Yeah, I'll take just that. I'll appreciate that for today. It's sunny. Rahel, thanks. Now, as we mentioned earlier, Amazon doubling down on its hardware ambitions, and it makes sense. It's Q4, showtime for hardware. It's got an Alexa-enabled robot, Astro. And as part of my West Coast tour, I had the chance to spend some time with Amazon Senior Vice President of Hardware, Dave Limp. Started off asking him how and when they decided to build a robot.
Yeah, I think we started the project about 4 years ago. And you know our invention process. We write a working backwards document. And we wrote a document where we thought customers especially would like the security aspects of a home robot. It since has evolved to cover much more surface area than that. But that was the original kind of idea. And we then you ask the question, are technologies ready for it at a price point that are even possible for a home-based robot? And we saw that sensors had begun to evolve, and state-of-the-art of processing the systems on a chip had enough AI that you could start thinking that maybe we could actually run these navigation algorithms locally and those kinds of things. And the combination of that sort of got us excited about, well, we should get started on this.
When you think about, I don't know whether to call it privacy exactly, but that factor of, well, now there's a camera and microphone in my home that moves. It's not just in one room, it's potentially in any room on this floor. How much did you think about that and how people will either be comfortable or not comfortable with it?
Yeah, we thought a lot about it. As you can imagine, when you're coming up with kind of new ideas, and this is, I think, foundationally a different type of robot for the home, you do have to think about privacy as a foundational thing. And so a couple of things we thought of. We did the things we've already done on Echo-like devices. So if you hit the mute button, we electrically disconnect the microphones and the cameras so that nobody could see through them. But secondarily, we also knew that one of the use cases is to remote control this device from your app. And so thinking about, you want to go check on your cat, as an example, and go find it and see what your cat is up to. But if somebody's in the home, we want them to be the primary sort of arbiter of that experience. So before the cameras go live, the screen comes up and it starts beeping at a pretty loud volume and says, hey, somebody's going into live view. And if you cancel that, then it doesn't matter. The remote person can't come in. So that was one additional feature once we started thinking about the mobility solution. Another one was, when you first set up the device, it maps your home. Basically, it goes around autonomously and maps your home. And then it presents you a map. But another feature we've added is the ability to, say, keep away zones, places that you don't want it to go. The best design for that is a door. Obviously, that's what we use in our everyday lives. If you're in bedroom and you don't want somebody to come in, close the door. But beyond that, you can then just draw on the map, don't go into this room ever. And then the device can't even navigate into it. It's sort of a standoff zone.
I want to talk business a bit, because it seems to me you've got TVs that are above $500 and a little bit above $1,000. Mm-hmm. You got a $1,000 robot. This isn't like kind of experimental hardware anymore when you're in that premium consumer price point. it feels to me like something has shifted in Amazon's aggressiveness in consumer hardware. Has it?
I think we still find some of our highest volume products are the ones that are around $50. You know, an Echo Dot, our best seller, our Fire TV stick at $50, around $50, one of our best sellers, our tablets around $50, one of our best sellers. That being said, some of these brands have been around for a while, and as that happens, customers ask us to, you know, add more features and to move it. And also the amount of resources that we have as we've scaled the business has increased as well. So when you have those two things, there's a customer demand and our ability to kind of tackle some of these bigger problems, I think you're right.
So we talked robots at some low volume. You're not announcing a big rollout of that yet, but updates to the Echo Show and Ring and Blink and Kindle, which we haven't talked about here, but we could, all in an environment where supply chains and components, things are tight. What gives you the confidence to do it?
You know, there's chipset shortages in certain cases. There's transportation shortages. Any given week, a factory, for the right reasons, could be shutting down because they have COVID cases and they do need to take care of the workers. So, you know, it's a very moving target right now. You know, I wake up almost every morning with something happening. It may be very different. I give you three examples. There may be many more. But I think the reason that we're confident is that our business has been pretty predictable over the past few years in terms of its growth. There was some unprecedented growth during COVID, but now we're kind of understand it. And for a long time, we've been forecasting pretty far out. And so for the components that are the hardest to get, doesn't mean we're not getting surprises like others. Because the forecasts have been a little bit out, it's been a little bit more predictable for our suppliers. And I can't speak for other folks. And I also, will we have shortages in certain products? My guess is yes. But right now, I feel like we have a pretty good grasp.
You know about how many Kindles you sell, I imagine, and about how many doorbells and that sort of thing. Do you handle inventory differently given the shortages and given the transportation issues? Is that part of your planning?
I think transportation arcs certainly come into play. There's no question about it, which is, you know, and you know, as you look at the number of boats that are available in different parts of the world, ships, container ships, versus how much air capacity, you're certainly looking at balancing those kinds of things. Obviously, each transportation arc has a different cost associated with it, so you're also balancing the availability of something with the chance that something might be less affordable for customers. So those are trade-offs that we're making all the time.
So is part of what you're saying that you might have to do some more air freight in some cases because, I mean, we know that the shipping situation is volatile and that could end up affecting margins to some extent?
It's not necessarily margins because you might also, you know, you might pass some of, if that's planful, some of that might just be you price it into the product and you do that. But I think that generally, we're planning those transportation arcs pretty early on because the lead time to get something onto a ship is very early on.
Is that why, to some degree, it makes sense to launch premium products that consumers have been asking for in an environment where things are tighter? Because it does, I mean, you can justify a higher price with more features.
It gives more predictability. And so I think you might change your tactics a little bit, but I personally would be, and I would recommend everybody be very wary if you're trying to look at supply chain issues and not building what customers want. Focus on what customers want, and customers love products under $50.
Well, Carl, I think we've learned quite a bit this week about from Amazon, from Microsoft, about supply chain, the way they're thinking about it. It's critical in Q4. Amazon was able to ramp the lower cost items earlier in the year and sort of take some of the risk out there. Premium products are better positioned in this inflationary and tight supply chain environment in Q4 if companies have done the right planning. So it seems to me that that's going to be a key factor in these Q4 earnings when we eventually get them January, February, who was able to have the right mix of premium and who was able to do the right kind of planning around when these things launched, Carl. That applies to Apple and so many others as well.
It's so fascinating, John. And I do wonder, we've been talking about Amazon's seemingly renewed interest in hardware, whether it's televisions, whether it's Astro. But I wonder how far you think it goes and what the flywheel effects will be on the core retail business and things like Prime Video.
Well, it's interesting, Carl, and also, Julia, the fact that they're moving into this $1,000 price, and they're doing it with content, right? We talked about the exercise content that they have, the nutrition content they have. They tie some of that back to Whole Foods through the wearable device that they have. If they stick to that, and a lot of times Amazon sticks to these initiatives long-term once it locks into them, it's gonna be quite a challenge for Apple, for Peloton, for Google Fit, for others who also wanna make some hay in this space.
Yeah, and that focus on content, John, it seems to be central to so many of these companies. But when you talk about content, you also talk about advertising. And we can't forget that Amazon is a growing force in the digital advertising space. Number three, of course, behind Facebook and Google, but growing very quickly. So I'm sure that plays into that as well. You can walk around your house and order things on these robots. And also, I'm sure, eventually get fed some ads by them as well. And meanwhile, Cathie Wood's ARK Innovation ETF seeing its biggest ever quarter of outflows, almost $2 billion leaving the fund through late September. And don't forget, top holding Tesla, could new delivery numbers drive that stock higher? That is next, so stay with us.
Tesla's Q3 deliveries expected in the coming days. Our Phil LeBeau's got a preview. Hi again, Phil.
Hey, Carl, when we look at the third quarter for Tesla, it will be a record one in terms of deliveries. That's the expectation. And we've seen nothing that tells us that won't be the case. The estimate is for 227,000 vehicles to be delivered, though there are some who believe it could be as high as 235, 240,000. 90% of the deliveries, Model 3, Model Y. That's been the case really since the beginning of the year. Regions are not broken out. In other words, they're not going to tell us, here's how many we delivered in China, here's how many we delivered in the U.S. and in Europe, et cetera. They've never done that. In terms of the impact of the chip shortage, well, Tesla has felt an impact, and Elon Musk has talked about that over the last couple of months, but it seems to be more limited than what other automakers around the world have been experiencing. Perhaps we'll get a better sense in the next couple of weeks as they report their earnings as well as have their annual meeting, exactly what's going on. Remember, the Berlin Gigafactory, that is scheduled to open this quarter. And then we also have Austin, Texas, which is on deck as well. In terms of annual deliveries from Tesla, the estimate right now is for 871,000 vehicles. That is going to be well above what they delivered last year. And most believe that there's a chance that we could see them tickle 900,000, though they would really have to push it in the fourth quarter, and I'm not sure they'll be able to do that. Finally, as you take a look at shares of Tesla, it's been a nice three-month run here. Shares have had a nice steady progression higher. Remember, the annual meeting is next week, and then you've got Tesla's Q3 financial report. That's likely coming in 2 or 3 weeks. We don't have the exact date yet. Guys, back to you.
Thanks so much, Phil. And that stock up about 15% over the past 3 months. And of course, autos are one of the many sectors impacted by the semiconductor shortage. Just when will it end? Hear Marvel Tech's prediction later this hour. Plus, Loop Capital's no longer a renter, but a buyer, upgrading Airbnb to buy and saying, quote, Benioff is right. We are not all going back to in-person work. Catch that call at CNBC.com. Stay with us. Facebook finding itself playing defense again this week following yesterday's hearings. A key whistleblower set to testify in front of the Senate on Tuesday. Casey Newton of Platformer called the leaked research from the whistleblower, quote, a significant threat to the company, and described Facebook as a, quote, company losing its grip on the narrative. Casey joins us now. Casey, what's going to happen as a result of all of this? We saw another analyst initiating Facebook with a buy rating yesterday. The stock wasn't really impacted by the hearing at all. What's the impact?
Well, look, I understand why the stock isn't moving. There's been a long history of these Facebook scandals that come along, and there's a congressional hearing, and then nothing happens, right? But I do think that we still have a couple more turns of the screw yet to come. The first is that the whistleblower is going to give an interview to 60 Minutes on Sunday. Who knows what she will say? And then the whistleblower will testify before Congress. And apparently, she brought thousands of documents with her when she left Menlo Park. So we just have to sort of wait and see what is in those documents and what the reaction is.
But play out the potential, you know, like things that could happen here. One question. Does Facebook like totally scuttle its plans to have Instagram for kids? Another thing, are they no longer going to be targeting teen users? Are they going to lose their grip entirely on that teen demographic? What is the potential outcome here?
Sure. So, I mean, one potential outcome is that, yes, they just simply do not build that Instagram for kids app. I think they're really committed to doing it, though, so I would be surprised. The other ramifications have to do with what their research team finds out about what the long-term use of social networks does to our mental health, does to society. They're researching all of these questions. One question is Congress going to compel them to share that with the rest of us, right? There's a lot of material here that is in the public interest that is not being shared, and I wouldn't be surprised if Congress compels Facebook at some point to release it. And then the final thing is, yesterday we already saw several members of Congress introduce or reintroduce legislation that would either compel Facebook to share more or would attempt to regulate them in various ways.
Casey, I've been racking my brain on this one, and the best thing I've come up with so far is that Facebook, this means Facebook has lost the argument with Apple over, you know, privacy protection versus data access and all it can do for you. Even if nothing else happens, you know, stock-wise, all of that, that Facebook versus Apple stuff, trust us with your data, Apple's closing us off unnecessarily, I think they lose that argument with Tim Cook now. I didn't want them tracking me before. I certainly don't want them tracking me or my kids now, and I feel fine about that.
Yeah, I hear you. I agree completely. Look, on some level, I do think that there is something almost superstitious about some of our fears with regard to how these companies are using our data, right? It's not so much that there are concrete harms as much as we're just kind of worried about what might happen or how it might be affecting us in ways that we don't totally understand. Apple has a much clearer value proposition. Pay me a bunch of money for a phone, buy a few services for me. We're going to keep way less data about you. That's a much easier argument to win.
Casey, I know you've written a little bit about this episode being slightly different in that it's being originated by former insiders. I wonder how significant you think that is. And also the Oversight Council, the Oversight Board, at what point does that sort of lose its usefulness for the company to say that they really are monitoring themselves?
Well, I mean, so start with the Oversight Board. You know, there was this sort of honestly funny moment in one of these first Wall Street Journal stories where it was revealed that Facebook had essentially been lying to the board about how it uses a program called CrossCheck, where it sort of creates a special set of content moderation guidelines for elite users. So the board is presumably very mad about that. They're going to have a meeting with Facebook coming up soon to try to sort all of that out. So who knows how that goes or how effective the board will be. But to your first point, I think this is a really big deal. You know, so often when a company finds itself in crisis, they want to turn around and point fingers back at the press and say, oh, there the press goes again, right? Here's just a bunch of clickbait and trolls. But it's much harder to dismiss when it's your own current and former employees who are saying, we're sounding alarms internally. No one is paying attention. No one is taking us seriously. That's a much harder thing for a company like Facebook to shake off.
Well, Facebook has shrugged off a lot of issues and regulatory scrutiny in the past. We'll have to see, Casey, if this time is different. Great to see you.
Great to see you.
We are getting some news out of the White House on ransomware and cybercrime. Let's get to Eamon Javers. Hi, Eamon.
Good morning, Carl. The White House is confirming that President Biden is going to convene 30 nations in a counter-ransomware initiative. This will be a meeting hosted by the National Security Council at the White House. The goal here is to get their arms around this ransomware scourge that we've seen hitting companies across corporate America over the past year or so. The White House saying that part of the goal here is to accelerate our cooperation in combating cybercrime, improving law enforcement collaboration, stemming the illicit use of cryptocurrency, and engaging on these issues diplomatically. So the idea here is to gather these 30 nations virtually, at least at first. There'll be follow-on meetings after that. And of course, the problem with ransomware is that it is a global phenomenon. The bad actors here are often outside U.S. legal jurisdiction. They're hitting multinational corporations. They're using cryptocurrency, which is circling the globe. Any one nation taking action on that really faces a problem of the fact that the bad guys can just sort of evade that nation's rules and regulations. So by acting together, the theory is here, these 30 countries will be able to crack down more intently on ransomware and really put some of the squeeze on that hasn't been there in the past. We'll wait to see exactly who's attending and more of the details here. But the White House now confirming they are going to convene 30 nations in a cybercrime initiative, and that'll happen this month. Carl, back over to you.
Oh, fascinating, Eamon. Thank you, Eamon Javers. We do have some big news from inside CNBC today from our own Jim Cramer, which will now be delivered right to your inbox with the CNBC Investing Club. You see it right there. You can register at cnbc.com/investment club or through the QR code on your screen. Basically, Jim's going to send daily emails, write for the website, appear in videos online, all to give you his unique insights into the markets. And you'll have a front row seat to what stocks Jim is trading in his charitable trust. He'll tell you all about his winners, his losers, total transparency. As he told us earlier on Squawk on the Street, Jim's goal has always been to be a teacher, and the Investing Club allows him to do just that.
To educate and teach in a recommended list, so you can say, look, that one's too risky for me. That one's got dividends that I like, and we rank everything. We also rank what we're about to sell, what we don't like, price targets. It's kind of like a brokerage house with, we don't want your commission. We just want you to learn.
Maybe more important, Jim points out the club comes at the right time as a new class of investors are coming into the market.
It's really good for this younger generation, the Robin Hood generation that wants so much to have fundamentals. What are fundamentals? Why does something go up? Why is something recommended? And it's the why. And I think the why has been lacking, and the club is going to give you the why.
So you can sign up to find out more, as we said, cnbc.com/investing club, or just point your phone at the QR code on your screen, and it'll take you there. Make sure to take a look. In the meantime, S&P back to 4330. More tech check after this.
We've been talking a lot about supply chain here on Tech Check over the last few weeks and months. Leaders across the industry have been trying to deal with bottlenecks in this pandemic. It was also the focus of yesterday's town hall of CNBC's Technology Executive Council. Semiconductors have been one of the hardest hit sectors. I moderated a conversation with leaders that included Marvell's tech CEO, Matt Murphy. He had this to say about the shortage.
Right now, every single end market for semiconductors is up simultaneously. And that's, I've been in this industry 27 years. I've never seen that happen. It's unprecedented. So I think what happens is, if it stays business as usual and everything's up and to the right, this is going to be a very painful period, including in 2022, for the duration of the year.
Want to hear more? If you're a tech leader who wants to join the council, head to cnbc.com/TEC. More Tech Check after one last break.
Bumping up against 4330, as we said a few moments ago, Dow's up 240. Next week, we're going to start to get some of those preliminary earnings reports from the likes of Pepsi, Levi's, Constellation, and of course, the jobs number a week from today. You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.